All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. I know, that's a couple of weeks ago. But I want to welcome you to our program. We got a special group of people that I'm really anxious to introduce to our audience. These are our board members. Remember when we talk about Veterans Radio, I think it was about 3 years ago, we decided that we were going to become a nonprofit, which we are, under the name Veterans Radio America. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization now. And so we are deciding we're going to introduce all of our board members over the next couple of months so that you can see who's actually running the show, not me anymore. It's all of them. So if you get mad, just send emails to the board members and they can take care of them. So we are going to talk to three of our women board members today because, it's International Women's Month. And I thought it'd be really interesting to have you meet these women who are just amazing backgrounds. We have Army, we have Coast Guard, we have people that are teaching at Army War College now. We'll fill all that in as we go along. So before we get into introducing them, I need to thank our sponsors because without them, we can't do this program ever. So first of all, is Legal Help for Veterans, and Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veteran disability claims. If you have a question, give them a call at 800-693-4800, or you can go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of a veteran-owned business. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. These folks, the NVBDC, it's really important. If you are a veteran-owned business and you want to do business with the federal government or many corporations, you need to be certified as a real live veteran-owned business. And so these are the folks that can get you certified and get you into that marketplace. So NVBDC.org, check them out. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to make sure that we thank our local veterans organizations for their longtime support. And that would be the Irwin Press Corps and American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we also want to thank you for helping us out with our fundraising attempts and activities. And if you'd like to support Veterans Radio, you can just go to our website, that's veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. We're, since this is our 20th year, actually we're going into our 21st year, we're just asking for $20 for 20 years. So if you click on that button, we would greatly appreciate that. All right, so here we go, the official part of the program. So joining me right now, let's see, I don't know how to do that. I guess I better do it by rank, something like that. So I'm going to start out with our highest ranking board member, and that is Dr./Colonel Christine Cook. Christine was in the Army. She was in the Reserve. She was in the National Guard. She deployed, so I'm going to introduce her first. So Christine, welcome back to Veterans Radio on the air.
Good to be here.
So fill in what else you've done.
What else have I done? Well, I basically was commissioned in 1986, and I served for 30 years, so I retired in 2016. I was first in three different National Guards, New Jersey, then Pennsylvania, and then finally in Michigan before coming over to what some people refer to as the dark side in the U.S. Army Reserve, where I was for 8 years before I retired. Then I went back for my PhD, got that, and about a month later, a job opened up at the War College again, and I'm there now.
Okay, and you are originally from where?
I am originally an Army brat, so I am from nowhere and everywhere, but my father retired to this area, which is near Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and I am from Ann Arbor, Michigan now.
Okay, thank you. Next on our list is Kate Melcher. Kate was a captain in the Army. I always like to brag that I know an amazing woman helicopter pilot. So, Kate, tell me a little bit about your background and how you got here.
Thanks, Dale. I joined the Army after 9/11. I was working in the U.S. Senate at the time, and as one of my duties was drafting letters to Gold Star mothers, I thought that was not the way that I wanted to spend either the Iraq or Afghanistan war. And so I enlisted in the military. I was selected for OCS and flight school, but was derailed a little bit because of my previous civilian experience. So I actually spent the bulk of my active duty time not just flying Apache helicopters, but actually as a legislative liaison officer back at the Pentagon, helping teach Congress what the military needs to do the mission that they've asked us to do. So through that, I got to travel quite a bit domestically. I was stationed at a number of different places throughout the U.S., but I am most proud of the wings that I earned. And I know you know that feeling, getting those Army aviator wings. I am most proud of that and of the work that the team did to get supplemental appropriations to up armor Humvees to make sure that more men and women actually came back from theater.
All right, we're going to go into more detail on some of these things in a little bit. So last but not least, of course, is, hold on, I got to get my paper out here. So we have Lydia Pinkham, who's our Coast Guardie, Coastie. And Lydia was in the Coast Guard from 2011 to 2017. She was an E5 machinery technician second class. So Lydia, tell me, how did you get involved in joining the Coast Guard?
Initially, I met a recruiter who said, I was a swimmer at the time, and he said, have you ever thought about joining the Coast Guard to be a swimmer? And I said, what's the Coast Guard? And learned all about it over the course of about a year. I told him to call me a year later, and he called me to the day a year later. And I signed papers to leave about 6 months later, but they were trying to get me to leave the following Tuesday because they desperately needed women. And from there, I spent time in Seattle, Alaska, Virginia, and Florida. The ship in the Pacific Ocean went up to the Bering Sea all the way down to coasts of Panama and Colombia. Everything from drug interdiction to fisheries enforcement. And then I spent the last 4 years doing a combination of search and rescue and tactical response for the Port of Tampa in Florida near MacDill Air Force Base.
Okay. Well, see, we have a very, very talented board here at Veterans Radio. And, okay, so let's talk about some of the experiences that you had while you were in the military. And so, Christine, you said that for 30 years you were in and out, but you also deployed to Kuwait, right?
I did. So basically, as I said, I was in the National Guard. And then as a lieutenant colonel, that was 2004, after 9/11 happened. It was one of those things where it wasn't a matter of if we were going to deploy. We knew that it was a matter of when. So for me, it was I got my call up in the end of 2003, and I went forward in 2004. While I personally was stationed in Kuwait, I was a battalion commander, and my 250 some soldiers were all over the place. So I ended up in Talil. I ended up in Qatar because I had a group of people who were there, and then sprinkled all over Kuwait where my soldiers were at. So that was 2004 into 2005.
And what was your, again, the mission of your group while you were there?
So I was a personnel services battalion commander. So what we were really doing mostly was reception, staging, and onward movement and integration, plus bringing people back out. So we were in charge of making sure that everybody who came into country, and that included not just Iraq, but also Afghanistan, we had to make sure that all their records were right and that they were prepared to go forward. And then we also were the group of people who would be the last people to hand them off before they got back on the plane to go back home again.
Okay, so basically everybody came into where you were and then they deployed either to Iraq or Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I didn't know that. See folks, you learn new things. Sort of like the 90th replacement company for those of you from that era.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So we reached out and touched about 250,000 soldiers during our time there.
Wow. Wow. So I know that you, I should have pointed this out. I guess I can come back to, I'll talk about it now. You also wrote a book about your experiences there.
Two, actually, but one that I published personally and one that was published through the Strategic Studies Institute, which is outside of Carlisle here. So the first one was called Living on Tatooine, aka Kuwait. And it was basically, I had gotten into country. I had a 5-year-old and a 9-year-old back home. My husband was having a conniption. And so in order to kind of calm them and my Girl Scout troop and my church and all of those, you know, everybody else, I wrote home an email every week that was mostly funny. You know, trying to say, well, I'm going to laugh at this in 10 years, so I may as well laugh at it now. And it was also mostly to say, hey, I'm still alive. Don't worry about me. I'm okay. Right. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, because of the fact that I had had to kind of, you know, dress up things to not give away state secrets and stuff like that, I was able to go back and say, well, this was actually what was happening, or this kind of explained some of the stuff that I was not able to say when I was in country. And so I did that, dressed it up a little bit, had some pictures added, and then published it.
I know it's over there. I'm pointing toward my bookcase. It's back there. Actually, if you want to find out more about Christine's book, you can listen, go back into the archives of Veterans Radio, just type in her name, Christine Cook, and the program that she was on should come up. We talked with her about her book, and we also talked with her and her husband about the deployment and the fun that he had while she was
fun. So
we want you to do that. I felt so bad for Ken.
The other book was about post-integration, post-deployment integration, reintegration, because even if you don't have PTSD, sometimes you have like, what was this all for kind of moments, and trying to get myself back into the family and, you know, part of the family again. So I wrote a book that was the same basic way, where I did a week a year for the second year when I was back home, trying to figure out how to navigate the United States again.
I can...
And that one's available. You can Google it.
So. All right. So, Lydia, you mentioned that you were all over the place, it sounds like. Tell me a little bit about your experiences in the Coast Guard and how much, you know, what did you find to be the most valuable lesson that you took away from that?
I don't think that I could really narrow it down to one most valuable lesson. The locations-wise, I started right after boot camp on a big ship that was based out of Seattle, but would spend half the year up circling in the Bering Sea. And up there, we were doing search and rescue and fisheries enforcement in partnership with NOAA. So quite literally measuring fish with tape measures to make sure that nobody was catching anything illegal. And then the rest of the year, we were down in the winter months. We snowbird boat went down to Colombia and Panama, Central America areas. And that was following intel for drug interdiction, trying to catch the little boats full of drugs. And then, so we would circle around the Bering, stop in port for repairs, go down south, and then come back to report for repairs. And it was that cycle for a couple years. And then from there, I went to a machinery and engineering school in Virginia, and then got orders down to, they call it station vacation in Florida. It was basically a beachside search station. That was pretty wonderful. And when I was at that station, they were in desperate need of female law enforcement officers. So I kind of got pushed into the law enforcement world, which wasn't wasn't exactly what I wanted, but I could shoot and it was a fun adrenaline rush. So I ended up doing a lot of law enforcement and tactical response in Tampa Bay for my last couple of years. But lessons wise, I think a lot of my life since then has been a lot of logistics and organization, and I'm in the geoscience world now, but managing, coordinating research projects, helping to manage people, and seeing all of the moving parts of a problem at once instead of just a tiny little detail. I think that the logistics and organization part of my brain that learned a lot of that in the military is probably the best lesson, best thing that I've taken away from that, because it helps me so much in my job today.
Okay, Kate.
So, Dale, I know you are doing this interview, but you can't let Lydia off your program without saying a couple of things because clearly humility is something else that she learned in the Coast Guard. Because you are actually talking to the enlisted person of the year,
Oh my.
Lydia Pinkham, and you're also talking to somebody who had to do PT tests in the icy waters of the Bering Sea, and you should definitely ask her about that.
PT test in the Bering Sea. That sounds like just wonderful.
It sounds really cold, and I know my parents are listening right now, so I will apologize publicly for not telling them about the time that I got hypothermia. They found out a few months later, and I took a verbal beating for that. No, we had to test all of our dry suits in the water, and we had to know what it felt like if we were going to fall overboard. And those are the adrenaline rushes that I miss sometimes. But it was, yeah, the Bering Sea was a it's kind of a power you don't really understand until you're there. It's really glassy, calm, and gray, and then all of a sudden you have wicked high seas and winds, and your boat is taking a 35-degree lean, and machinery is falling all over the place, and it's an adventure. So, thank you, Kate, for putting me on the spot.
I have to let our audience know that Kate and Lydia have known each other for a little while, and I think they know. I should just sit back and let them talk. But so, and Lydia can probably fill me in on some stuff. Kate's not gonna volunteer either. So you, Kate, we had Kate Melcher on a program again. If you wanted to listen to her interview, you can go to our archives, veteransradio.org, and Kate. Type in her name, Kate Melcher, Melcher, and she'll talk about her training to become an Army pilot, which was a lot more complicated than mine was, that was for sure. So just as a review, I can't remember the new name of Fort Rucker.
Novacell.
There we go. So tell me just briefly for our audience, if you could talk about how you got into flight school, why you got into flight school, and then just a little bit about your training, how the length of it and what you learned to do.
Sure. I chose aviation because it was the closest thing to combat that women were allowed to do at the time. I was in the training pipeline, when the prohibition against women in combat still existed, women were not allowed in combat arms, MOSs. But interestingly enough, attack aviation in the Army is not combat arms. It's actually combat support. So women were allowed to do that. After having the experience of seeing all of these letters to Gold Star mothers going out from the Senate office, I wanted to be in a position to affect greater change. I wanted to be in a position to maybe make so that so many letters didn't have to be sent. And I knew that as a lieutenant in the Army or in the Marine Corps, where you have leadership opportunities immediately upon commissioning, that was an opportunity for me to do that. And I also knew that in a two-theater war, the chances of me deploying overseas were really high. And if I was going to deploy overseas, I wanted guns and lots of them. Because people were going to be shooting at us, and I wanted to be able to return the favor. So close air support was that mission. That is what I wanted. So I did well enough in OCS and found a unit that took me seriously when I said I wanted to fly, and they sponsored my packet to actually go to flight school. And I just remained laser focused on not only meeting but exceeding the standard, because I wanted my choice of aircraft. I wanted my choice of mission. There's so much that you're not in control of in the Army, but your merit and your performance does get a vote. So I went through primary school, which everybody goes through. It's where you learn to fly a helicopter, and everybody kind of feels like they're wrestling a squirrel for about a week. And then all of a sudden you find your hover button and you just know how to hover, and you can't explain how that happened.
No.
It's just magically, it just happened, and you can hold a low hover. But they basically, you know, you learn all of the ways you can die, and then you spend flight school figuring out all the ways to not do that. So you go through primary, you go through some basic warfighter skills, and then the selection process happens, and I ended up in the 64 course for Apaches.
Okay. Lots of guns, lots of bullets.
Yes.
Lots of noise.
Mm-hmm. And lots of fun.
I know, we can't really say how much fun it was to do that kind of stuff. At least, well, I wasn't in the Bering Sea, so I can't talk about that. I did have a friend that was stationed up in Alaska. He said it wasn't fun. I can kind of relate to that whole thing. You mentioned earlier on, and I thought this was kind of an interesting question before we went on the air. She said to ask about uniforms. And from the standpoint of male and female uniforms, I had always assumed that they were different, and evidently they aren't.
So I will say this, as a female in a very technical field, the mission and your proficiency in the aircraft was the most important thing. Your gender barely mattered at all, because the idea was, show up, can you do the job or not? But because there's sort of inequality in the genders in a technical field like aviation, some of the small things I think kind of go unnoticed. Like physically, I'm a taller woman, but I have slight shoulders, and I have fuller hips and rear end. And when I went to get a pickle suit, you know, which is the green flight suit, you guys all saw them in Top Gun, those kinds of things, those are all cut for men. And if I was going to get a flight suit that could comfortably support my lower assets, usually was way too big on the top half of my body. And this is not vanity. This is not fashion. When you have all of that excess material, it can get caught on things. You know, when you're climbing up on top and you're doing pre-flight on a helicopter, it can get caught. It didn't change a whole lot when we went to two-piece flight suits. It was the same kind of issue. And, you know, we sort of overcame, you get things altered. You know, there's other less savory topics, like women use the restroom differently than men do. And that's also a challenge with uniforms. So while there were different uniforms for your dress uniforms, your class A's, your blues, all that, your field kit was a one-size-fits-all issue.
One size fits all and unisex. And what they really meant was it was male, work with it.
Correct. Correct. I mentioned that some of that is sort of a safety issue. The larger safety issue actually came with my IHADS helmet. So for those of you that are not familiar with the Apache, we actually wear a helmet, and there's a system called IHADS, which is a teeny tiny little TV screen that shows up in front of your right eye. And your flight symbology and, you know, mission essential information comes through that little TV screen. Well, the way your helmet fits dictates how that screen lands in front of your eye. And it's very important for it to be in the same spot every time. You know, things look differently from different vantage points, and, you know, a few millimeters can make a difference. So as a female with a smaller head and smaller features, finding a helmet that fit me appropriately so that that IHADS assembly didn't slide down my cheek and end up under my nose in flight, you know, that was really important too. So I visited the LC shop a lot to try and make it work. And, you know, I ended up with a little sack of lead ball bearings on the back of my helmet and all kinds of crazy, sort of jerry-rig solutions. But these are the kinds of things that, because there was such equity and equality between men and women in the mission of aviation, those little things like, oh, she is different. Her body is smaller. Her body is shaped differently, and it's going to make a difference for her uniform and her equipment. We all figured it out, but definitely not something that folks thought about when I showed up in the unit for the first time.
The other thing that was fun was the Kevlar vest,
Oh,
which is
yes.
when it has all of the Kevlar plates in it, it weighs 80 pounds. It weighs 40 pounds without the plates, but it's 80 pounds with the plates, which when you're in combat, that could be more than half of your weight that you're trying to figure out how to get on. And I actually got to the point where I would do this fancy little whoop like this, where I would circle it around me to set it up onto my shoulders, and then I would be able to get it on from there. But it was tough to get in and out of.
I actually got to reap the benefits of a unit starting to integrate women into a crew. My Kevlar was custom fit so that I could swim in it during surface swimming operations.
Well,
So
wait, you swam with Kevlar?
that was the first time that I ever had something that was custom fit or very intentional for a woman on a crew, and I had to be able to with a full gun belt and signal vest, everything with the bulletproof vest on underneath it, I had to have full range of motion to be able to swim. And when I got to my unit, the guys weren't too happy that I got custom fit for a brand new Kevlar, and they were using hand-me-downs. But that was pretty nice. But up in the Bering Sea, we had the wetsuits that would keep us. They were dry, basically a wetsuit with gaskets around all of the holes that would keep us perfectly dry in the water. And for sake of bathroom purposes, they had finally purchased women's suits that, instead of unzipping in the front for men, they had a half zipper in the back for women. And the unit invested in the women's cut suits. However, the thermal bunny suits that we had to wear underneath them were unisex. And even if you were able to unzip the whole dry suit, you still had to just take it off anyways to use
Oh,
the
good.
thermal suit underneath it. So while I perfectly understand that budgets are a thing and that units have to order what they can get their hands on, just a perfect example of how the gear does not always fit the mission for everybody. It was frustrating, but we made it work because you always make it work. So.
Yep. And going back to that Kevlar vest, as you can tell, I really loved it. The other thing is, if you happen to have a full bust, it's basically a binding mechanism, right? So it would smush down all of your chest in order to fit under these steel plates. Very comfortable.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at this at all. I wish that we were on television right now. You could see the reaction of all our guests as they're talking about this equipment that has to be adapted to. I was thinking of, I mean, obviously, as the guy in the room, our helmets, flight helmets, were much simpler. They were small, medium, large. That was it. I had in my head is fairly big, and even a large sometime would cut off the circulation in my head, and it didn't have any weights there. The chicken plate or the armor plate, I guess pre-Kevlar. We would only wear the front part of it because theoretically the backs of the seats were armor plated, and the seat itself was armor plated, and they wanted us to wear Kevlar leg guards, sort of like a I don't know, like a robot, and it was going to cover the legs. So when because that's where many pilots, when they got shot in the legs, and but you couldn't move your legs. It was like you had Forrest Gump leg braces on, and so they I'm guessing that they did away with those. I'm assuming that they did. We are going to take a real quick break here for our Medal of Honor segment. When we come back with our guests, are Christine Cook, Kate Melcher, and Lydia Pinkham, and they are board members for Veterans Radio America and Veterans. As you can see, everything on Veterans Radio America is veteran-oriented and run by veterans. And so we're asking for your support. If you'd like to hear the stories like we're talking about today or any of the other ones that we've covered over the last 20 years, please just go to our website, click on that donate button. It's really helpful. We have a lot of plans of things that we want to do in the future to expand not only our listening audience, but to expand the mission that we are on to help other veterans. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Navy Captain James Stockdale inflicted a near-fatal wound to himself to show his willingness to die rather than divulge information. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Stockdale was recognized by the North Vietnamese as the leader in the prisoners of war resistance to interrogation and in their refusal to participate in propaganda exploitation. Sensing the start of another purge and aware that his earlier efforts at self-disfiguration to dissuade his captors from exploiting him for propaganda purposes had resulted in cruel and agonizing punishment, Stockdale resolved to make himself a symbol of resistance regardless of personal sacrifice. He deliberately inflicted a near-mortal wound to his person in order to convince his captors of his willingness to give up his life rather than capitulate. He was subsequently discovered and revived by the North Vietnamese, who, convinced of his indomitable spirit, abated in their employment of excessive harassment and torture toward all of the prisoners of war. Upon release from the captivity, he was promoted to Rear Admiral.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
You know you don't have to wear your PT gear anymore, right?
It's comfortable.
So how's civilian life treating you?
It's fine.
When I got out, I didn't want to admit that there was anything wrong because it felt like a failure. And then I realized, like, there's nothing to be ashamed of. So I started talking to someone. Maybe you are fine. But if you're not, it's okay.
Thank you.
If you or a veteran you know needs support, don't wait. Reach out. Find resources at va.gov/reach.
We're back here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with the board members of Veterans Radio and Veterans Radio America. We've got Christine Cook, Kate Melcher, and Lydia Pinkham. So we've got two Army and a Coast Guard. What I'd like to go into now is a little bit about your transitioning from the military back into some semblance of civilian life, you know, once you're retired, let's put it that way. And so, Lydia, I'm going to start with you. What did you do when you got out, or did you have a plan already in place?
I definitely had a plan because that's my personality. I started school about 3 weeks after my last day of active duty, so I jumped right into it, and I used my GI Bill for a bachelor's in geology and then went on to graduate school in geochemistry, and now I'm advising PhD students in an aerospace engineering department, so it's a lot of the coordination and personnel management that I was talking about earlier, just helping to solve problems and helping them see the big picture. So I went from being on a boat every day, standing on the bow, doing a hands-on job with direct rewards every day, to sitting in a lecture hall full of a couple hundred people taking classes at U of M. And I think the hardest part about those first couple months was the feeling that I wasn't doing anything, directly contributing to society every day, not seeing that direct reward of feeling really useful. And, you know, I kind of hated doing homework, so that didn't help. But I think that was the hardest part for me. I also, when I went to the VA to sign up for healthcare benefits, the person at the desk wasn't aware that the Coast Guard was eligible for the same benefits as the other branches. So that was my first hurdle straight out the gate. But since then, I had wonderful access to the Ann Arbor healthcare system. That honestly made most of the transition out easy, having just, I mean, the Ann Arbor system right there is pretty great. And I've kind of filled in the military helping people gap by getting involved with Veterans Radio here and also getting involved at Fisher House with Kate. And it's, I think that's been the easiest way for me to keep that helping people aspect, but also moving forward in a different path. But since then it's been pretty good. I think the communities of student veterans and the vets out here, the friends that we have out here, I live in Colorado now. We left that out at the beginning. The communities are really what's helped with the transition out of military life. I think if I didn't have the student veteran population and some of the friends that I've made since getting out, it would have been a lot harder.
I know you were active in the University of Michigan Student Veterans Association. Did you start that or was it already there when you got there?
The student veteran group, the SVA, that was formed, I believe, in 2008. So it's been around for a while, but it's a mixture of professional development and social and supporting each other through classes. So I also, there's a an office at the University of Michigan dedicated to student veteran affairs, and there's a peer advising position that I worked in for a couple of years, serving as an advisor for incoming veteran or military affiliated students. And that was that feeling of giving back to students that had been in the same position that I was pretty fulfilling. But that helped me get in touch with a lot of other vets on campus to relate to and right. commiserate.
No, I think that's terrific. I mean, the idea of being able to, of you know, the educational institution that you went to, when I got out and was transferring into U of M, first of all, they wanted to charge me out-of-state tuition because I was in Alabama, they thought. And I said, no, I'm here permanently. And it took me a while. Finally, there's a congressman that returned. I don't know who he called, but evidently they did give me the in-state tuition, which was very helpful because my GI Bill was, I think, $400 a month. At the time, but it covered it all, which is saying something in relationship to today. But I do like the idea of all of these, all the colleges, at least I know in this local area, that have these veteran transition departments, offices. They kind of, you know, they're all reaching out to help their veteran community and help that transition back. So, Kate, when you transitioned out, how long were you in the service? Total amount of time.
I enlisted in 2005 and I was done with my reserve component obligation in 2020.
How long were you on active duty?
So 8 years.
Okay. All right.
So in that regard, I the sort of slow motion nature of my transition was helpful in a lot of ways and not in others. So I really am of two minds about this question. First of all, when I came off active duty and started working in a guard unit, I went to work for L3, which was an aerospace company, and I got to be a part of building aircraft that were going to the military, commercial as well. But I was surrounded by a bunch of really talented, technically proficient people. So that was a really pretty smooth transition, not just because some of the guys that worked there were veterans, but as a whole, I went from a technically proficient, really competent unit to a similar thing on the civilian side at L3. So I made friends and learned a lot from the people there. And so that part of the transition was easy. The part that wasn't was while I was working there and still serving in the guard at the time, the unit that I transferred out of was sourced and they deployed to Afghanistan. And two of the guys in that unit, their aircraft never returned to base. So while I was sitting at a cushy little civilian job at a desk in Crestview, Florida, you know, there were two families that were grieving CW3 Matt Ruffner and CW2 Jarrett Yoder. And the survivor guilt that came with that incident sticks with me today. I left L3 and ended up coming back to Michigan and working for Fisher House. And when people ask me why I work for Fisher House and why I do what I do, it is 100% to earn the right to still be here, because I should have been on that deployment and wasn't. So I continue to serve my military brothers and sisters and their family members and their caregivers and the greater community outside of just the veteran space, because Matt and Jarrett can't be.
And so right now, what is your role with Fisher House? I know our audience, refresh them. We all know what it is, but just kind of refresh their memories.
Sure. The easiest thing, and I love when people use the analogy that a Fisher House is kind of like a Ronald McDonald House. Fisher Houses are comfort homes built near military and VA hospitals so that when a service member or veteran is hospitalized, we get to take care of their families. They come and stay at Fisher House so long as it's medically necessary for their loved one. And so currently I'm the executive director of Fisher House here in Michigan. We have an active Fisher House in Ann Arbor, and the Detroit Fisher House is currently under construction.
Pretty cool. I know you've been very busy. This is how I met Kate, was through the Fisher House connection, and that you're working on another one, where, up north, right?
Well, Fisher House Michigan, we've decided that we will support any Fisher House that the VA says that we need. And there are 5 VA medical centers, hospital centers here in Michigan. One is up in Iron Mountain in the UP on the Wisconsin border, and they are anxious to apply for a Fisher House. If and when they apply and the VA secretary approves their application, we will also support their effort to build up there and to support the veteran families that need to be there for their loved ones.
I heard a rumor about expansion of the Ann Arbor House.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. You know, that house opened during the pandemic in June of 2020. And even though it had limited capacity during the pandemic, that house has still served about 9,000 individuals, making it one of the busier Fisher houses in the entire network of 96 houses worldwide. So if that Ann Arbor house has to run at 90% capacity for more than a year, they can apply for a second Fisher house. And we will happily raise funds and awareness to make sure that that happens.
Cool. Now, stick around, listen to Veterans Radio, see what goes on with Fisher House. Ann Arbor's putting additions on every single building, I think, around the whole area. So you never know what will happen. Thanks. So Christine is our colonel / doctor / professor. And right now she's sitting in Carlisle, Pennsylvania at the Army War College. So tell me about how did you end up there?
Well, as I kind of intimated with the second book that I wrote about reintegration, my reintegration was kind of tough. And part of that was, I think, because of the part-time, you know, I had been full-time for a year and a half and then suddenly had to come back and trying to figure out how to rebuild a trust issue that was significant with my guard unit at that point. And I was at 22 years, I was ready to hang up my spurs. But at that moment, I happened to be taking the U.S. Army War College distance version myself. And so I met a couple of people who found out that I was a writer. And they were basically, we've got a position for you here if you are ever interested, but it's not a National Guard position. It's a reserve position. So I figured, well, it's either retirement or let's try this for a bit, and found a vein of gold that I absolutely adored. And I ended up becoming what was a professor, but a practitioner professor in the distance version of the War College, where I was teaching the operational and strategic aspects of being a military person. So I did that for the balance of my last 8 years. And basically, when I did retire, I retired kicking and screaming because I really didn't want to leave at that point, which was a big turnaround from my 22-year point. But 2 years before that, I realized, gee, I would really like to be able to continue to teach if I could. And so I knew if I wanted to do that and not be a practitioner, a colonel at the War College, I would have to get a PhD. So I was getting a master's degree at Eastern Michigan in gender and gender and women's studies. And I wrote a historiography on women in the military, thinking, okay, this will be easy. This is something I know, and found out that there is virtually nothing written on the history of women in the military. And what they do have is basically World War II. That's pretty much it, right? So I was talking to somebody there, and they said, well, you know, you have a gap that you can fill because you have some experiential knowledge here. So Wayne State had a PhD program that they can kind of call a boutique program, in that you can kind of write your own adventure. So I went in there basically saying, I want to do the Women's Army Corps, even though they don't really have a military history department there. They welcomed me in, and I was able to finish a PhD in history, with a focus on my dissertation being on the history of the Cold War Women's Army Corps from 1948 to 1978. So I am now a subject matter expert in that particular field of history. And a month after I got my sheepskin, the position that I am now in opened up. It is a DA civilian Title 10 position, which is basically professorial for a variety of their colleges. And I am able to do it teleworking, which is one of the reasons why I spend most of my time in Ann Arbor, but have to do this little foray to Carlisle on a monthly basis.
Okay. So my question is, we're coming up about a little over 10, 12 minutes to go. Is what would you say to women today that are thinking about joining the military? Anybody want to jump in on that? I'm kind of curious. Okay. About that.
I will say, first of all, Dale, up to this point, I really appreciate you asking us specific and individual questions, because often as a female who served in uniform, I get the, what's it like to be a woman in uniform? And my experience was so unique that I don't like talking in a way that is representative of all women in uniform. So I would say to any young girls that are interested in serving that no two experiences are alike, that it can be one of the most difficult jobs in the world that is incredibly rewarding, that the technical fields are a wonderful place where it doesn't matter if you're a woman or not. You actually just get to show up and show your mettle. You can either do the job or you can't. I think the military in many ways is better at that than the civilian world. So I sort of joke that I'm a Nike feminist, that we now no longer have any laws that prohibit us from doing anything. So just do it. Either you have the aptitude for it or you don't. But just do it. There are no laws tying your hands to any job in the military at this point, any job anywhere, frankly. So I would absolutely encourage young women, if they want a job that is competitive and interesting and purposeful. But ultimately, it's not about being a girl. It's about executing the mission.
Interesting. Lydia?
I agree with Kate wholeheartedly that the opportunities are there, and if you want them, you have to go for them. Nobody's gonna just wait for something to fall in your lap. You have to shoot for it. Whenever people ask about my experience, I know that I had, just like Kate, I had a unique experience. I got along with most everybody that I was stationed with. Things were a bit lonely when I was the only girl on the crew, but I eventually met some of the spouses and girlfriends that became really good friends. And I had this like massive group of brothers that were very protective, and I loved it. I loved hanging out with the guys. So I had a very unique experience, but one of my closest mentors, another pilot, Kate, her best advice to me when I got to my first unit was, don't be lazy. Don't ask people to do things for you. You can carry that five gallon bucket of oil by yourself. And if you're smart, hang on to that and use it. And don't, you know, don't try to get out of things. Do your job, do it well, and people will recognize you for the job that you're doing. And we used to give that advice for all of the girls that came to the unit, and it's advice that really works for everybody. The men should do that too. But it was, to this day, it was the best decision I've made. Second to getting out was a really good decision for me. But my advice is just like Kate's. It would be to do it and have the confidence to go after what you want to do. If there's a particular job you want, if there's a qualification that you want, there's nothing that says you can't do it if you're qualified and if you meet the requirements. And so don't hold back. But it's a fun experience, and it personally helped with my probably discipline and confidence and public speaking and all of those kind of secondary qualities that you bring out of the military. It helped me with all of those things. It was a great decision.
Christine, I mean, Christine is went to school in New Jersey at one of the better known schools there, but I won't mention its name.
One of them. I was a mercenary soldier. I joined the military because I couldn't have afforded my other school otherwise. However, I agree with what Lydia and Kate said, but I will sound a tone of a little bit more of a negative portion of that. And perhaps it's because I was the one who spent the longest period of time, 30 years. And by the time I hit Lieutenant Colonel, I started finding out that there were pieces of glass ceiling all around me that I kept hitting pretty hard on a couple of occasions. It is a boys' club. There is no doubt about that. And to back up what Lydia said, you will succeed really, really well if you act like one of the guys. So this is a period, a place where you can really succeed really, really well. But you have to be willing to take some of the sacrifices that go with that by acting like a guy, by not taking any kind of, what from anybody, and by, picking up that 5-gallon slop jar yourself and not expecting anybody else to take it. You have to have a very thick skin to be able to handle some of the things that basically should have been Me Too movement. But because of the fact that we wanted to remain in the military, we just pretended it didn't just happen. But would I suggest it to somebody? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I think the thing about being in the military is the whole adventure of the whole thing. And, for whether you're a man or a woman, the whole idea of having this adventure in your life, I think is important. And we talked about this briefly a couple of weeks ago about mandatory service. And we just thought that, if everybody not necessarily had to be in the military, but was active in doing something to support the country and to support our ideals and so forth, that it would be to their benefit. And then, if you're in the military, when you get out, you got all these benefits that come back to you. You've got college, you've got housing loans, you've got medical care, second to none, based on a lot of statistics out there. So we've got about 2 minutes to go. So I'm going to ask you, that's all we've got. So each one of you, if you have something that you would like to add to the conversation, please do so. No, well, perfect. All right.
Dead air.
You don't have any dead air. Derek, edit that out. All right. So we've been talking today about women in the military. We've been talking with the board members of Veterans Radio America. And I just wanted to let you find out, who is supporting this project and this mission. And we had Kate Melcher, who is, United States Army, Dr. Christine Cook, retired colonel in the Army, 30 years. And Lydia Pinkham, the United States Coast Guard, E5 machinery technician, second class. I've got to talk with Lydia off the air to find out what the heck my father's rank was, because he was in the Coast Guard. I've never quite figured it out. It's E7 something. So anyway, thank you, ladies, for being on the program. And it's such a pleasure to have you on our board. And it's such a really my pleasure to know you. In actuality, because I get to find out all kinds of different perspectives about what's going on out there in the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dale.
Thanks, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. We only need to continue this. We got 10 seconds. We got to go. So this is Dale Thronberry for all of us here at Veterans Radio saying we'll be back next week. And until then, you are dismissed.